welcome to a new episode of the International Comics Collective, only on UCPN.
Hey everybody, welcome to a new International Comics Collective, and I'm your host, Al Mega, with the usual panelists all the way across the pond, the one and only Mr. Dave Elliott.
Boom!
I'm
here!
And then none other than, of course, Comic Crusader himself, master of the Twitterverse when it comes to comic book conversation, the one and only Mr. Chris Buse. What's going on, brother?
Yeah, I'm fine. How are you today, Al?
We're doing great, man. It's the weekend. I'm off and hanging out with the International Comic Collective team. Sundays, you know, start off fun.
Good.
Yeah, and I know today's topic. Yeah, and today's topic I know is going to be hella fun because it's about a legend that every comic book fan in the world should know of and probably has come across at one point or another in their collecting life. Would you agree on that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Any self-respecting fan has come across.
Oh, wow.
Boom, boom, boom. Shots being fired, folks. If you don't already know.
Going for the throats right away. Wow.
Hey, you know, these Brits, they're serious. You know, gung-ho. Yeah. They ain't playing around. Take no prisoners.
Hey, we're all about, like here, we're all about royalty. And that's what we're talking about today.
Man, the one and only Jack the King. Kirby.
Amen, brother.
Yeah, he was definitely an amazing creator. And, you know, we were very blessed to have, you know, Jack, because without Jack, there would be many things we wouldn't be able to discuss today.
Hey, we probably wouldn't even be talking today.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, he's definitely one of the architects of Marvel, if not the architect. But we're not going to talk about Marvel today. We're going to talk about a specific creation of his that is definitely mind-blowing. We're going to start seeing seeds of it across film, if you will. And I mean, this is a very big legendary story that I don't think ever really got finished, so in a way it did, but it could continue because there's so much depth to it and lore. I'm talking about nothing other than the Fourth World.
Yeah.
And the Fourth World is amazing. It's so amazing that Chris wrote one hell of a column that's due out on New Comic Book Day. So you're going to visit Comic Crusaders and make sure to read that. But I'm going to leave the floor to Chris and Dave here because these guys have been having monstrous conversations on Twitter from what, in a lot of respects to Kirby. So guys, let the world know and put them on to Kirby's Fourth World.
Dave, you want to go first?
You're the one who's, because if you're listening this the day it's released, tomorrow you'll be able to read Chris's column. If you're listening to this after the 26th of August 2019, go to Comic Crusaders. Go to Chris Buse's column page. You'll find it. But read everything you see there first. Read it.
Yeah, it's a hell of a read. You know, thank you, Chris, for saying that over. I've been fortunate enough to get the advance on it, being the editor of the site. So, yeah, it's get ready, folks.
Thank you for hosting me. it's lots of fun. It's lots of fun. And today we are talking about Kirby. I think the man doesn't need any introduction. I mean, if you want to read up on him, I touch a little bit on his history in my column, of course. But I also put my main focus on some of his marvelous creations for not Marvel, but DC Comics in the 70s. And I talk especially about Mr. Miracle, but you can't talk about Mr. Miracle without touching on the other books he worked on for DC that together comprise the so-called Fourth World. This is four books, and he started out with Jimmy Olsen, and maybe we can start with Jimmy Olsen if you want to. And there's a little story that goes with Jimmy Olsen, and I touch on that in my column as well. And I stop it with the plug, but it's interesting, and I don't know if the story is true, but it sounds very true, that when Jack came over to DC, it took a while to get him over. But when he came over, he said, well, basically, I don't want to get any guy fired from a book. What is a book that has no stable creative team? Give me that book. I don't want to see a guy put out in the street only because I am here. And they said, well, the only book we have that is not really was a creative team is Jimmy Olsen. And you wouldn't want to do that. And he said, no, give it to me. And I think that says a lot about the humbleness of this master artist who mm-hmm. basically come to DC and said, well, basically, here I am. I'm going to rule this shop now. No. He said, well, basically, I want to start a couple of new books, but give me a book that's already there, and I will work on it no matter what it is, and I will make it work. Well, and I think we can learn a lot from that.
Well, not only that, it was he was given a book that was, you know, wasn't a good seller. And that I think that was the other part of the thing that Kirby was, you know, going to offer. You know, it wasn't, hey, give me Superman or give me Action Comics. It was, no, give me a lesser title and I'll build its sales up. I'll show you what I can do.
But the irony is, Dave, and I would not have known that, but I'm currently working on or researching a bunch of other columns, and I checked the sales numbers. Do you know what the highest or fifth highest selling book in the late 60s was? That was Jimmy Olsen.
Wow, really?
It was not a poor seller. Do you know what the fourth highest selling book was? That was Lois Lane.
Well,
Batman was on 9. Detective Comics was on 20. Huh. That changed with the television show, but once the show was over, these titles dropped again. Archie was the number 3 selling comic in the late 60s. So I think we go to these books with today's perspective and say, well, basically, Jimmy Olsen, what a shit. It can't sell very nice. It did. And it was not a low-selling book, but it was a book DC didn't pay much attention to it. And Kirby changed that. But still, and this is also indicative of what we were probably going to talk about later, it's even then they messed with him. They had Al Plastino redraw the Superman's face. And the Third World books, originally, Kirby wanted them to be 3 separate books, Mr. Miracle, Forever People, and the New Gods. And the thing was, and this is why Jimmy Olsen was for a while the only book Kirby was doing, except for Crime Magazine, the Black and White magazine that had only one issue, Days of the Mob. But other than that, Kirby was not doing anything at DC. That was simply because he had planned for these other 3 books to go ahead with Jimmy Olsen. But DC said, well, basically, no, these are new books. We want to try them and showcase. And he said, no, you're not going to do that. And so they basically said, well, and that's why only a few months later, the second book came out, and that was Forever People. And then the New Gods came, and then Mr. Miracle.
Yeah, man. Luckily, it took DC, what, 2 years to bring him over to DC while he was working at Marvel?
Totally right. Totally true.
And it looks like Marvel, you know, they didn't just want to listen to any more of his ideas, unfortunately, because, you know, if you look at the New Gods, you know, it's basically some of the aspects of, you know, some of that Thor mythology, you know, that he was touching upon within the Marvel U and didn't get to expand upon. But, you know, lucky he brought that and created a new slew of characters, you know, or mm-hmm. his new Asgard, if you will. Because that's just what all this is, you know.
Well, you can see that creative line. If you go back to the original Journey into Mystery Thor's stories and see that evolution, so that by the time the title switched from Journey into Mystery to Thor, the book had already massively evolved in that state, in that period. And if you look at the trajectory it was on, you can only imagine that, in a way, you can actually see that Kirby was like, yeah, at this point, I'm building to Ragnarok. And at the end of Ragnarok, it's going to give us a whole new universe of characters.
A whole bunch of new gods.
You can see that. Yeah, exactly. You can see that pathway. Only what happened.
Absolutely.
But he had a detour. The last part of that pathway appeared at DC Comics.
That's true, and he was already preparing for that in the backup Asgardian tales, where he already, I believe it was Thor or Odin, have the story of Ragnarok retold, and the imagery he uses is very, very similar to the imagery he uses on the first page of the New Gods. So basically, it was the same idea to say, well, basically, we lay waste to the old universe and we'll build a new one. And metaphorically speaking, that was, of course, his way of saying, well, forget my earlier work. That was not my work. That was co-created. It didn't shake out the way I had intended it. And this is now my work.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
It was his world. Written, absolutely, drawn, and edited by Jack Kirby.
Mm-hmm. For better or worse.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, like going back to what you was your comments on Jimmy Olsen and the sales before he came on. It's one of those things that, see, again, it's, I think we as fans, because we are fans, we've got into the world, we've collected, and we look at what we like, what we care for. And then you look back, at the 60s. And as you said, Archie was one of the biggest selling titles out there, the biggest selling comic out there. Well, if you look at it at that perspective, Jimmy Olsen, people would go, oh, Jimmy, oh, this looks like Archie. You know, Lois Lane looks like Betty. Or is it Veronica? Which one's the blonde? I can't remember.
Betty's the blonde.
Yeah, so it's Veronica. So it's literally like, so, you know, it's Jimmy Olsen, you know, it's Archie comic and Veronica. And I think that's also very telling that, you know, the bigger the mass market was there telling people, it had the message. The message was there. Hey, you know, about we are different to the comic market. We as comic fans are more continuity driven. This goes back to even like some of our previous conversations about those early days of collecting, where I wasn't necessarily getting every single issue of everything. I was getting certain issues of Batman and Superman, World's Finest, Action Comics, Detective, and at that point in my life, none of those comics were continued stories. So it didn't matter that they were self-contained and there was no continuity.
Yeah.
So, you know, and again, you've got those people that are those Jimmy Olsen figures and those Lois Lane figures weren't actually necessarily consistent. So while they might have been, let's say they were selling 400,000 copies each, 500,000 copies each.
You're totally right. I've opened the sales numbers for, I can't, they don't have any, I'm on Comic Chrome.
Yeah.
And I have the numbers for 69. And Archie is the number one book in 69 on average for the year.
Right.
And that sold 500,000 copies on average monthly.
Yeah.
And Superman is very, very close behind. It's only a few issues difference. And then it's Superboy. And then we have Superman, Scurf, and Lois Lane. Then we have Betty and Veronica. And then we have Action Comics. And number seven, The Amazing Spider-Man.
Wow.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Batman,
after the end of the TV show, was selling 150,000 copies less than Action Comics. When the show was on, when the show was in its second year, Batman sold 800,000 copies.
Ooh,
Well, at its best, Batman and Detective were selling something like about 900, not quite a million, but very close.
Detective didn't do that well. Detective sold around 500,000.
But Batman?
Batman sold quite well, actually.
Mm.
And for the first time when the show was on Beat Superman, that was the first time ever.
Yeah.
It was insane.
And it's strange that you look at that, and here we are today, and everyone seems to focus on Batman. And for some reason, particularly you hear so many creators saying, I can't, you know, it's like Superman's boring.
Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, if you bring us back to the king,
mm-hmm.
I will argue with anyone that some of the best scenes and some of the best moments and heartfelt moments with Superman were done by Jack Kirby and Jimmy Olsen.
Absolutely.
And that first issue of Forever People.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's very good. It's the first real introduction of Darkseid. A lot of people don't know that.
Yeah, exactly. We only had a head appear in Jimmy Olsen. That was only him on the screen. Mm, up until Forever People, when we got to see who the hell Darkseid is.
And it's so interesting how small he is in that first issue of Forever People. He isn't that much taller than Beautiful Dreamer, actually. He looks very fun.
He was the Napoleon of Apocalypse, apparently.
yeah, basically.
But he was never, I mean, this is the thing that if you look at all those early appearances, his appearances in Forever People, it was, here's this guy who, he doesn't punch. He's too cool. He has everything set up. Someone leaps towards him, and he's like, "Nah, if you make a move on me, what's going to happen to Beautiful Dreamer?"
Absolutely.
You know, it's yeah. And later on in Forever People, he met them again, and again they were scared. They were scared of him.
Mm-hmm.
They but not only scared, they respected him. And there wasn't this thing that had become prevalent in comics later on, which is just. Forever People meets Darkseid. They have to fight him. They have to punch him. They have to be, there's a big fight. He actually had conversations. There was, you know, Darkseid was too cool to get into fist fight.
I think what's so interesting is if you take Forever People and deconstruct it a little bit, it's basically hippies against the men.
Very much.
And he made the most of it. It's very allegorical. That's where they don't fit in. They have their own ideas. They have their own dreams. And, well, he has that grand scheme, and he has it all lined up, and they don't fit in. It's quite an interesting read if you read it this way.
Oh, no, I loved Forever People. But if you look at them as a whole, if you look at them as – even if you eliminate Jimmy Olsen from the mix, even if you just focus on Mr. Miracle, Forever People, and New Gods – New Gods, the original, if you remember, for several issues, the full title was Orion of the New Gods.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's perfect.
And so the New Gods was primarily the focus of Orion, Darkseid's son.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Miracle, the focus of Highfather's son.
Uh-huh.
And so what you've got is the two sons on either side of this conflict, of the main players on that conflict. But you've got the New Gods, which is the main battle. That's the main battleground. Here's where the big battles are taking place between New Genesis and Apocalypse. Mr. Miracle was building to that, as you've got Scott Free having gotten free of Apocalypse, wanting to get out there, find himself a little bit, but he's getting pulled back. He gets drawn back. He gets, you know, Granny Goodness isn't going to let him go. And he gets pulled back into the conflict. And we, in the later issues, we actually get to see his full story.
Mm-hmm.
But then Forever People is literally, it's like the guys who are like, hey man, it's like, you know, if you think about this, this is Vietnam going on right now. So these are the guys like, we don't dig this fight, man.
Yeah, chill out.
Yeah.
What is this? It's not our conflict.
Yeah.
Right. But they still get drawn into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's so interesting that when you look at Forever People, it goes completely against, well, all the Force World books go against that, but we're talking about Forever People. Completely goes against the traditional hero concepts, because they are not really on a journey, and they're not really super. They're not really competent.
Exactly,
they fail a lot of times. They have to learn They're not successful at the end of the story. If you take the Flash, for example, a new villain would beat him in on the first couple of pages, and then the Flash would go in his workshop, figure it out, and by the end of the issue, you would have found a scientific solution to beat that guy. That's not in Forever People. The Forever People fail all the time. They're quite interesting.
Yeah, because in the term of them being gods, they are actually adolescents.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, so you know they had this very young and refreshing take. You know, it's mm-hmm. the millennials, if you will, of the new gods.
Well, it's funny how it was only years later that it was actually Barry Windsor Smith that took the title of Young Gods, which would have been a great, which would have been a great title to describe, you know, the Forever People.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And when you look at those issues that are set on Apocalypse, on Genesis, on your Genesis, you see a lot of young people around. There's not only Highfather and the main players. You see a lot of young people in the background. So you get an idea that this is a universe that is growing. It's not like the Greek gods where they're all already at the height of their power and they're all adults. No, you see a lot of young people. And that's quite interesting.
Oh, the children at play, that he would actually put them in the foreground. There'd be mm-hmm. a meeting, someone would be going to meet Highfather, but in the foreground, you've got these young kids playing on these weird sort of toys in the air, and they're spinning around mm-hmm. on wheels and, you know, flying around.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of like, yeah, this is this land of, this glorious land of the new gods. Mm-hmm. But we would always see that they would be joyful, they'd be playing, but we mm-hmm. knew very quickly the threat. There was a real threat there. But in many ways, how you see in many other war zones, you know, mm-hmm. there's bombings go on, but you still, between the bombings, the kids come out and play.
That's true. That's a very good point, Dave.
And I think there's little tiny touches that I can only attribute to Kirby through his experience, both in the war and as a father.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I mean, can you imagine? I know as a father, it's like that concept. If you look, go to the New Gods and the Pact, where Highfather and Darkseid first agree to swap their sons, their firstborn sons.
Mm-hmm.
That's some crazy shit. I wouldn't do that.
Exactly. Man. It's like, that is the sacrifice. And the fact that Highfather threw himself in to making sure that Orion had the love that he would have given to Scot-Free.
Yeah, and you mm-hmm. see the conflict in Orion. He has this light side and this dark side, and he's struggling to keep the light side on top.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no wonder they're kind of a little schizo, both of them, right? Can you blame them?
Absolutely.
And they're also kind of, you know, he introduced that type of feelings as well in the comics, well, that schizophrenic type feeling, you know, of these characters, if you will. Because Mr. Miracle, man, he poor guy, went through a lot.
Well, remember that whether they're willing or not, they were soldiers.
Yeah.
So PTSD is kind of just lying there. It's potentially
and with this, I mean, he had obviously a definitive end in mind, you know, for this as well. and DC tried to block him in all aspects, you know, from what I understand, and trying to conclude the series, because I guess, you know, again, you know, another Ragnarok. But did you like their idea of them, you know, just doing a conclusion of where it ended up in Hunger Dogs?
No, I don't think so. I think the problem was that they I'm not really sure if Kirby really had an endpoint in mind. Maybe I'm wrong here. He did have
an endpoint. It was called On the Road to Armageddon. You know, and then, you know, they did it. That was a definitive end in the series. DC said no. And then he turned in a new story called Even Gods Must Die, was published instead. You know, it was the sixth issue of a reprint series, you know, where they had what was it, 1984, the 1984 reprints of the New Gods.
Yeah, on the back
sixth issue series. Yeah, yeah.
The whole back paper, exactly.
The same thing.
So the Even Gods Must Die then was published instead of that series, the Armageddon, which was the prologue to the graphic novel, The Hundo Dogs, which was the only one greenlighted to conclude the series. So again, so he wanted to have a definitive end, but instead, you know, in The Hunger Dogs, they basically forced, you know, Darkseid and his allies into exile, you know, meaning not death.
It's interesting to note that The Hunger Dogs came much later, and that was when Janet Kane came in. And and she and Paul Levitz pushed for that, and they asked if Kirby wanted to finish his series. And it's interesting that Carmen and Infantino made the call to pull the series. Not all, except for Mr. Miracle, which they retooled basically into a regular superhero book. But even there, you have Kirby's vision and concepts. And then he brought in a young African-American kid to replace Mr. Miracle eventually. That was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, Shiloh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Mr. Miracle, definitely, because he was even featured, you know, on the Justice League International cartoon. So he was definitely, you know, one of the more popular New Gods. You know, I would think Orion, but Mr. Miracle is the one people connected with.
Well, Mr. Miracle, I think the thing with Mr. Miracle was he didn't come by himself. It was that dynamic of the married couple, him and Big Barda. Like, they were a couple. So in the Justice League, you didn't just get Mr. Miracle. You had Big Barda as well. Mm-hmm. And I think just as a very interesting dynamic is having someone who, you know, his girlfriend, wife is actually bigger than him.
Yeah, that'll be fun at the bar. Hey, honey, he's teasing me.
I take care of it.
Are you teasing my husband? That's it. You're out.
But it's also interesting if you put this in perspective. If you look at the New Frontier by Darwin Cook, Wonder Woman is taller than Superman.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, I will always think of a Wonder Woman being a big woman, Amazon warrior. I would think of her tall and strong, you know, at least 6 feet or something. You know, I would think. I don't see her, you know, that for me, that's I see her that strong. I don't know.
Yeah, it's funny. I think it was the New 52 or something. It was one of those things where I thought that would have been a great opportunity to have Wonder Woman portrayed if not as a make her African American, make her black, or at least made her much darker skinned, rather than, you know, having this white woman who's
on the beach all day, doesn't get a tan apparently.
yeah, that's one of her superpowers. I don't tan.
Right.
So Al, what is your favorite first world book?
Mine, I like the Orion and the New God story, because you know you got to meet the universe and cast of characters, you know, the Black Racer, Forager. I mean, I like Forager a lot too, and I like how they present them in the current cartoon as a real bug. I mean, it was different. I mean, you would think, but what was Jack Kirby on when he was thinking of all these concepts? I mean, was there something extra on those cigars he was smoking?
Well, think about the later issues when you got to like issue 9 with, you know, the or issue 8 with the fight with Terrible Turpin and Kalibak.
Oh yeah. Oh man, yeah, Kalibak, another one, man, awesome. Jealous son.
Right, but he's Darkseid's son, but you've also got that fight he had with a human, you know, that the detective, Terrible Turpin, and Dick Turpin, who just was, you know, and there's that moment where the New Gods step back and actually let him fight Kalibak. It's their code of conduct. He's challenged Kalibak to the fight, and they allow him to go into battle against Kalibak by himself. I always thought that was such a cool issue. And I always saw, it's funny, there was, I always saw Turpin as Jack Kirby.
Absolutely.
I mean, with a name that terrible, Trippie, it definitely sounds like something out of Brooklyn.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think it's funny though. It's because it's fourth world. I think that, you know, it's one of those stories where I don't think you can really, like, I couldn't answer that question, like, what's your favorite fourth world book? Because they complemented each other so well.
They do. Absolutely.
And even if he'd never done New Gods, Mr. Miracle, and Forever People, even if he'd just done his short run on Jimmy Olsen, oh my God, it's just like every single issue. It's like, okay, here's 20 ideas for you to use in the DC Universe.
Yeah.
Next issue.
He introduced the idea of cloning, I mean, in the early 70s. That is amazing.
Yeah. You know, he brought back his own characters in the 1940s as clones.
Mm-hmm.
And how crazy is that?
And he had the adult versions of them as being the ones that did it.
Mm-hmm.
Could you imagine had Kirby met Tesla instead of Lee? Oh my God! I think this would have been a fourth world already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, can you imagine? Yeah, that sitting around the table with like Einstein, Tesla, Kirby. Mm-hmm.
That would be insane. I was looking up a character because apparently when Chris was talking about the Jimmy Olsen character within that book. I guess because he was so mad at Stan, he created, you know, a news character based on Stan, but kind of making fun of him.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Funky Fleshman.
Yeah.
Funky Fleshman.
There mm-hmm. you go. Fun. What a name.
But that was Mr. Miracle. He,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's, I think, again, that... You see, again, when people go like, oh, I don't really like, you know, Jack Kirby's writing, it's like, I don't think he was that good a writer. It's like, you have to look at those three, four titles and mm-hmm. see how one creator who was writing and drawing wrote four different books, different themes. You know, Mr. Miracle, it worked so well because he would put those lighter comedic moments in. He had the Funky Flashman moments, but mm-hmm. then we had the issue with him and where we had the story of
its use. That's very depressing, actually.
Yeah. So you have, but again, it was that beautiful thing of, well, in New Gods, we got to see the pact. We got to see how the two sons were switched. And in Mr. Miracle, we got to see the other end. We got to see that mm-hmm. moment that Darkseid had been planning for. Where he'd beaten Scott down so much that Scott's free, he fled, and in leaving Apocalypse, gave Darkseid permission to start war again.
But what is so really interesting, and this is what I'm touching on my column, is that if you look at how Stan Lee would start an issue. An origin issue. You look at Daredevil number one. It's a complete story. You know exactly who Daredevil is. You see his whole life until the moment he puts on the costume. What I found so mind-blowing when I opened the first issue of Mr. Miracle, it has a cold open. And only over time you learn who these characters are. This is very modern storytelling.
Yeah.
That is very, very groundbreaking. If you look at classical number one issues. Oh, this is the hero. This is his backstory. This is how he came to be. Not so in these books. It's very interesting.
But he built mystery up. He built mystery up to the character. So when you saw the origin, it was like, wow, rather mm-hmm. front loading in that.
It actually feels. I mean, if people have not read The Fourth World, try to do it in one sitting. Because it's basically like a TV show. You need to binge watch it. Mm. Because it's basically not your typical story where the first issue is this and the second issue is that. But it's telling a complete, well, not really complete, but it's telling a story for first season of a TV show.
Yeah, and I like that comparison you made, that it is Bint. I mean, I think he's the one that created this. Let's tell a story, but mm-hmm. it could be told with little bits and pieces that could be spread out between four books. So now you got people buying four titles mm-hmm. if they want to feel that they have a complete story, although they could stand alone. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was a genius at that. I mean, what a great play. I mean, and that's something mm-hmm. I think he created, which obviously we see companies do nowadays nonstop.
Yeah, it's a big crossover, if you will.
Yeah. I mean, it's something that you was later extrapolated on, and in fact...
abused.
yes, that's a... Yeah.
Abused.
What if you think
pockets and collections, jeez.
Well, if you look at X-Men, for instance, how X-Men became... This became, there was so many X-Men titles and spin-offs. That's when it started to hit everyone's pocket. When mm-hmm. the rise in prices of comics, the large amount of titles, all the extra titles were coming out. And that's when you started to break that structure would break down of, hey, I'll buy everything Marvel, to I'm just going to buy the X-Men universe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They force you into that, unfortunately. Yeah.
But the problem with that is, okay, I get broken down. I'm now, all right, well, I like the X-Men and they're my favorite characters. I'm not going to miss it. If anything goes wrong, if you put on the wrong creative team that pisses off any of those people,
mm-hmm.
Chances are, not only will you lose them as X-Men readers, but you've lost them as Marvel readers because everything else, you can't just skip over back into... Well, I used to like the Fantastic Four Avengers, and it's like, whoa, what's going on here? Oh, I don't recognize these.
So Do you think that's what Kirby meant when he goes a brave, new, you know, a whole new world, you know, for Marvel readers that would jump ship with him and when he introduced the New Gods over at the DC?
I think that both Jack and DC hoped that that was going to be the case. And I think there certainly was to us, to agree. It's interesting that... the age I was at that time, that I hadn't actually bought an American Marvel comic off the newsstand at that age. But I'd read the reprints of the Marvel comics.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I bought the New Gods, Forever People, and Mr. Miracle off the newsstand because I was more comic shops carried, or more just general... You know, newsstands in the UK carried DC comics over Marvel comics.
Crazy. Mm-hmm.
So I was buying the Fourth World books as a 9-10-year-old.
Damn, dude, off the shelf?
Off the shelf.
Lucky wow. guy, I wish.
Amazing.
And it was, and it wasn't for probably about another maybe year before I actually realized that the Marvel stories that I was reading before that were reprints of American comics. I was at that young age that you're at where I wasn't even aware of it. Publishing companies didn't even matter. It was, I liked that comic.
Yeah, me too.
And I was going to buy that comic. And then you realize that, oh, these black and white stories I've been reading about these characters are actually reprints of color American comics.
And then you start discovering issue releases.
Yeah.
Come out every month, one at a time. Go to a newsstand, visit a shop, something.
and finding out that the newsstand, at least in the UK, the newsstand comics that were going on sale was 2, sometimes 3 months behind the American release.
Mm-hmm.
So when I started finding shops that had comics 3 months ahead of what was on the newsstand, wow.
I was going to say, thank God you didn't have Twitter back then. Shit, 3 months mm-hmm. of spoilers you couldn't avoid.
Yeah, well, absolutely. That's the thing. If we'd had Twitter then, I would have known earlier.
But you still would have gotten it 3 months later.
Well, it's funny. There's a little side note in that a lot of the, Marvel went through a period when, and it didn't last too long, but it was long enough when they were getting a big enough sales market in the UK that they actually did, they changed the plate on when they were printing comics so that the in the UK, it had a UK cover price on instead of a US cover price.
Okay. Yeah, the really pants. True. I actually have an X-Men, the issue after they get introduced, you know, that Cotton Faria cover.
Mm-hmm.
But I have the pants cover.
Right. And here's another interesting thing.
And it's the big difference in collectability. That's the big thing.
Well, no, here's the thing, though. I remember a period when I was told that because I had a lot of the Pence-covered comic Marvel comics, they weren't worth as much. So I was like, oh, man, oh, damn. But years later, it flipped to the point where once people realized, well, hold on a second. It is the UK edition, but there's less of them.
Exactly. It's rarer.
So exactly. It was what? Like the rare variant cover. So all of a sudden they became more expensive.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating.
Is that true today? Because I got that book there. Should I put it up on sale right now?
Oh, I'm sure you can find out with a quick Google search.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you see, he wants to compare American with UK dollars right now. And I'm not going to do that on this podcast. I know a dollar sucks right now, so I stop it. I'll save until I move over there, that way I can really make some bank.
Both the dollar and the pound suck right now, so we're in good company.
All right, so let's continue on our journey through the fourth world, you know, a little bit here, right? So he got to tell his tale, you know, because, you know, he came up with the concept of the Lord Apocalypse. I was about to say our Lord Apocalypse.
Maybe he is. Maybe he is.
He might be.
Yeah. Who knows, right? Maybe Jack was really on to something.
Maybe you already live in Darkseid's world.
Who knows? Well, take a look at Forever People. Forever People is another great example. The issue where the Forever Desad. Darkseid's right-hand evil genius captures the Forever People and locks them up in the, you know, some twisted Disneyland. If that isn't a view, like, you know, Kirby's view of the future, plus also in Forever People, we were introduced to Glorious Godfrey.
Godfrey, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Fascinating.
Yes, and doesn't he remind you of somebody in current politics?
Yeah.
So it's that
he
thing.
Should not be named.
But it's also interesting that the dark side doesn't need to raise a little finger to put him in his place, where he says, oh, you make nice words, but that's about it.
It's
really fascinating.
See, what I find crazy, this is what I want to kind of get into. And I want to see what you think Kirby's mind was at with what Darkseid was always after, which is the anti-life equation, a fictional mathematical equation that could take total control over the minds of sentient beings.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you read Final Crisis from DC Comics, we get to see the end result of what the anti-life equation does, which leads, you know, spoiler alert, into the world of Commandy, which is, what was it, Earth AD. What do you think that Kirby was inspired by with such a crazy idea like that?
I think Kirby knew well before. Like, you're talking about someone who had such a world experience. Like, he grew up on the Lower East Side of New York. He, you know, grew up in New York, which was a very cosmopolitan city, as an, you know, with a ton of immigrants. He moved to Los Angeles. So again, he's living in more than one city. He's got family, he's got kids. He went to war. He lived a life. He met, you know, hundreds of people, you know, on the front lines, at airports, in different states. So he'd experienced a lot, and he saw a lot. And if you look at it as well, I think that I don't want to completely sideline people like, you know, Stan Lee But I think, you know, the when you look at the Black Panther, I think the origin of a character like Black Panther, when you look at the types of people, a person that Jack Kirby was, probably really came from Stan. Like a lot of the characters that appeared in the Fantastic Four, the first Stan Lee saw of them was when the pages were delivered.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so I think that that's, he was sensitive to that. I think, and as well, look, he was Jewish and he wasn't a sort of a well-to-do Jewish person. He was, you know, very working class. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting when there was there's a little thing that I've thought about often when you mentioned Daredevil number one earlier about it being a complete story.
Yeah.
If you go back and you look at that time period, that was when Jack was still living in New York. Bill mm-hmm. Everett was living in New York. That area of New York where Jack was raised and Bill Everett had lots of boxing rings, their boxing gyms.
Oh, yeah.
So I actually think that although he only penciled the cover, I think Jack was definitely a consulting voice on that first issue of Daredevil and mm-hmm. that dynamic that and that world that Matt Murdock was raised in. And if you think, you had Bill Everett, who was, I think he was an alcoholic at 16.
Mm-hmm.
And came from a very troubled family.
Wow.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that there was a lot and, and Jack was clearly so instrumental in anything that came out from Marvel in the 60s, yes. particularly those 5 years.
Absolutely.
So I think, when I read that first issue of Daredevil, I can't help but see Jack's fingers in that story. And that's where I think that came from.
Well, just on that point, I still have the sales number for the year 1969 open. And it's interesting. I wanted to find the right moment to bring this in. If you look at the top 20, Fantastic Four is on number 12, and Thor is on number 17. The Incredible Hulk is on 18. These are books Kirby co-created. And he was still, not the Hulk, but he was still doing the other two at that time. And even he had even a hand in the creation of Amazing Spider-Man. So he was basically the rock star of comics.
Oh, definitely. Definitely a rock star.
Well, it's not even a rock star. I think that you have to, the more you look at it, let's be honest, let's look back. Let's take a wider look at history of comics, or even just a wider look at the history of comics over the last 100, 120 years. Who comes even close to achieving, on a creator level, and by creator, I mean creating characters, titles mm-hmm. that Jack Kirby did. We've got, we've talked often, I know we want to, at some point, we're going to probably do a couple of deep dives on Alan Moore at some point.
I definitely would love to, that nut, but he's definitely so creative.
Yeah, but you see, creative, and he's a fantastic writer. Honestly, like, if you actually look at create, as in from raw, like, you know, what did he create? What has anyone done that's on a par with Jack Kirby as far as creating new characters? And I'm not going to say like everything he created was, everything was wonderful and original. I mean, the Fantastic Four was pretty much Challengers of the Unknown, but with superpowers.
Which Kirby also co-created.
Exactly. But he reused his own ideas. He wasn't always, 100% original.
That's what did Moore.
Yeah.
Basically. Yeah. He basically reused the origin story or his origin story of Swamp Thing from his revamp of Mr. Miracle. It's basically the same story.
Yeah.
So, but what's so interesting for me is that Kirby was in his 60s when he created the New Gods. And then 10 years later, and not many people know this, but if you go back to the 80s, he created a new set of characters for Pacific Comics. He created Captain Victory,
mm-hmm.
and he created Silver Star. So he, in his 70s, he was still putting out new stuff and inventing new concepts. And I think that's the interesting thing. If you look at a lot of, or if you look at what's going on in media, a lot of these movies or comic books, they rely on old concepts. Disney is at the moment only mostly remaking old movies of theirs and relying on IPs that have been successful, like Star Wars. Kirby, when he got on something, he created something new, or at least he intended to. And that's quite interesting. It's not like, oh, I have this character, maybe I can do something with this character. No, he said, well, basically, I want something new. And that's so interesting. He was always innovating.
Well, I look at there's another aspect to that innovation and that creative force. So these days, if either of us or when a creator is asked for, hey, we want you to come on board, we want you to take over Batman. And so the first thing you're going to have to do is, what's your take? What are you going to do that's different to everybody else so far on Batman? And give us a year, maybe even 3 years arc. Right? What story are you going to tell over the next 2-3 years? Where are you going with the character? What changes are you going to make?
Mm-hmm.
And that's common. Every writer on every book has to have a direction. The editors, the publishers, sometimes it might even be handed down to the creator. It's like, here's mm-hmm. where we want to be with this character. We're going to give you some leeway as far as the stories you tell, but he's going to be in this crossover in 3 years' time, and this is going to happen mm-hmm. to him.
I have an idea. What if Batman smoked weed for 3 months straight without affecting him?
What I was going to say is, imagine in the 60s with Marvel, Kirby was doing that in the back of his head.
There was no
here's where we're going to be in a year's time with these books. It was just literally it was getting to the point where Stan would just have a phone conversation with Steve Ditko and Jack Kirby. What are you doing with these characters? I kind of thought it'd be cool to bring this character back. So if you could put this character in, that'd be great. Mm-hmm. And then Steve and Jack were drawing them, even to the point where in some months, Jack and Stan weren't even talking. It was like Stan would just get the package of art through from Jack with probably 2 or 3 different issues in it of different titles. And it was, okay. And don't forget with Jack, he dialogued most of it. If you actually go and look,
absolutely, yes, in the margins,
exactly
in the margins.
If you read some of those margins and read the printed comic, you know, Stan wasn't the writer. Stan was the editor. He was a good editor.
Yeah,
but he didn't actually change that much.
He wrote the dialogue basically.
Yeah,
to make it sound more like. Like him,
I would say cleaned up the dialogue, maybe.
Exactly. He was an editor. Mm-hmm. He did a good job of editing it.
Saying cleaned it up, and that's that. That's mm-hmm. all.
But mm-hmm. the thing is, though, the point I was trying to make is Jack did that on the fly. It was in the back of his head. He had a, whether it was conscious or unconscious, he was going in a direction. Each issue would build on the next. Each issue would build on the next. He'd develop it. He'd refine it. It was everything. Every single title was getting better and better.
Herein lies the pitfall of Kirby's life, because he was such a involved creator that he was missing an important aspect. And that was what he had with Joe Simon and what he had with Stan Lee, because Stan Lee and Joe Simon were both sales guys. And I think the failure, quote-unquote, the commercial failure of the New Gods has a lot to do with the fact that basically Carmen Infantino said, well, basically, okay, do your own thing. And they didn't give him any support. And they should have seen that these books needed a commercial hook.
Absolutely.
They needed to push these books, and that these were hard sells. That this was something completely different.
And, but I don't think, I don't think that they knew how to do that, because they couldn't do it for them. I mean, their books.
That's true.
You know, I mean, even though you like those sales figures you listed for Jimmy Olsen and Lois Lane, they weren't that happy with them. Like, to as far as they were griping about sales from 10 years before, they were like,
so there's something interesting. If you look at the I go into this in my Batman column. If you look at the attrition from year to year, they were losing across the board readers. There's a Comic Con has a very nice thing where you see the average number of if you take all the books and you take an average of that, and you see this number declining by 30,000 per year, and yet you see higher sales for the Marvel books. So you see DC was hurting from two sides. They were losing readers to Marvel, and the market was losing readers. And that's quite interesting.
And I just found a little bit of information here. Apparently, the issues, at least within DC, were that DC's policies and errors were not in sync with his creative impulses. So basically, he was often forced to work on characters and projects he didn't like. And apparently, there was some artists at DC that just didn't want him there, because they felt very threatened by him within the company. And of course, apparently the bad blood from previous competition and legal problems. And because he was working remotely, if you will, from the West Coast, they weren't able to undermine his work through redesigns. Mm-hmm. He lived in a different era. Because if it was right now, let me tell you, I won't say his name, you know, because he told me to keep it quiet. But there was an artist that I know from this coast that I saw on the other coast, and he couldn't enjoy the show he was at with the fans, because after they told him yes on some redesigns that he did, last minute while at the show, they tell him you have to redesign all these pages and rework them. So poor guy didn't even have to have fun. Well, I mean, what do you think about that? Do you think that there was really that much bad blood within the company while he was there? I mean, he was only there for, what, 5 years, if you will, 71 to 75. And within that time, he didn't just create the Fourth World, but obviously Old Man, Commandy, the Demon, Cobra, a new Sandman, the first issue series that introduced Atlas, the new Manhunter, you know, the Green Street team, all that good stuff. You know,
Losers. His run on Losers. Great war comic.
Yeah, Losers. Yep, absolutely. So what do you think? I mean, do you think that that's true, that while he was there, they were just really undermining him? I mean, why work on a goddamn contract for two years to bring him over to only undermine him in the 5 years he's there?
Because it's human. And I will just say from experience, I've seen so many companies fail, and from the outside, you think, oh, yeah, no, that didn't work. Oh, they had the wrong ideas. Oh, you know, they weren't getting enough sales. From the inside, I've seen differently. I've seen, no, what brought it down was basically humans, people, jealousy,
feelings.
Yeah. Yes, it's just, you know, yes, Carl Main might have fought hard. He might have gone and got permission to do it. Yes, we can bring Jack Kirby. Wow, I can bring the guy who's whipping our ass at Marvel, we can bring him over to DC. But in-house, there was a lot of people there who'd been there for a long time. And all of a sudden, all their hard work is potentially going to be sidelined by, oh, so we've all got to be Jack Kirby now, have we?
Yeah, but I mean, that's a kind of an asshole attitude when he purposely asked to be on a book that, you know, I know what Chris said, but, you know, you wouldn't think it was that popular. Yeah,
you know what? It doesn't matter. They just knew, like, just, you know, some of the ads we've shared, Chris and myself.
Exactly. I was about to go into that, because this is part of my column, because basically nobody had ever done this before. Nobody had ever announced the coming of a creator to a book at that point. That was unheard of.
A company. And it was not just a book, a company.
Yeah. Exactly, as a mystery at the beginning, and then they, well, Kirby's coming, and the way they promoted him, oh, the great one is coming. I mean, if you were like Al Pacino working on Superman, you said, well, basically, wait a minute, what is this? Of course it's strange bad blood.
I think the Al Pacinos in as well probably weren't the ones that would upset. It was probably the it was probably the in-house editors and staff at DC who had been
there was still bad blood from the Jack Schiff situation because basically he lost the lawsuit against one of the DC editors and he was persona non grata at DC for a long time because they had a miscommunication, shall we say, who is entitled to what royalties. And Schiff, who was an editor, powerful editor at DC, took Kirby to court. And that's why Kirby went back to Atlas Comics. Quite ironic.
Well, right after DC, he actually went to Marvel for 2 years because apparently back in 1975, they had the first ever Marvel Con. I was born that year. My parents didn't take me, though. How dare they?
Oh.
So they announced his return there. He only lasted 2 years, though, apparently.
Well, again, I think it was the same thing. He came back, but in that 5 years, 5 years, that may not seem like it. 5 years is a long time. New editors, new creators. So what's he going to do? Everyone's firmly comfortable on the books. They don't want to let him on anybody. Like, no, I'm happy. I'm going to keep on this book. I'm going to keep on this book. But Jack being Jack was like, okay, I'll just create a bunch.
Yeah, I just want to say this, though. In the 2 years that he went back to Marvel, right? He created the Eternals. See, basically, he brought the New God essence back into Marvel a different way, if you will. Mm-hmm. He created the Celestials, right? He then he produced an adaptation. What was it?
2001: A Space Odyssey.
2001: A Space Odyssey, right? Exactly. He did try to do an attempt at the television series The Prisoner. He did that Black Panther series, you know, when he finally got his own standalone line. He also created Machine Man and Devil Dinosaur within this fucking time.
Which he spun out of his 2001 series because they also created the comic series based on 2001.
But how insane is that? Into the creativity of Jack Kirby. He's for 5 years at DC, comes back tomorrow for two, and he creates all these characters that stand today and right, you know, as we speak, they're doing an Eternals movie.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. This man was just strictly amazing.
I mean, as somebody said on Twitter the other day, who ever thought that in our lifetimes we would see Marvel and DC working both at the same time, one working on the Eternals, one working on the New Gods?
Right? As movies.
It's amazing. It's also worth mentioning that when Kirby came onto the DC books in the early 70s, I think it is also fair to say, or at least I make the claim, I don't know if you agree, Dave, that at that time he was, as far as the fans were concerned, not a superstar anymore. Because at that time there were still coming new readers coming in. And if you looked at Neil Adams' Batman, that was where people were going. Or Stalin's Captain Marvel, Warlock came a little bit later.
Yeah.
Or Barry Sonson's Conan. This was something new.
The problem was that
people were not ready for what Kirby was offering. And I think that's also a reason why this failed. In hindsight, we see the New Gods as this big thing and we understand it. But it's also a testament to how ahead Kirby was. He was not delivering the next big superhero.
All I was going to say is this. I think that if his treatment from Marvel had been better, we would have seen the New Gods, Mr. Miracle, and Forever People at Marvel.
That's true. But do you think Marvel would have allowed the elimination of characters such as Thor and Odin and all that to bring about the world of the New Gods? Or do you think they would have somehow allowed it to, you know, live one in the same?
At that time, remember it, this would have still been the 60s. So we're not at that stage of mass merchandising of these characters yet. So I think that if Stan looked at it, he would have said, oh, we're going to lose one character and a couple of other characters that no one's really that, like, no one's interested in the, you know, Fendral and Hogan and Volstagg to a universe of, wow, oh, he's turned these superheroes. He really has turned the gods into superheroes now.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, would have actually, or should have been more attractive to Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
And he would have grown from there. I think it was only because as Marvel was in the ascendant and DC was going down, Kirby could have pulled up DC if they had embraced him.
Exactly. And the interesting thing is that you see at that time in Marvel with the new creators coming in, like Jim Starlin, they're moving into the cosmic.
New
gods would have fit right in.
Oh yeah.
They didn't fit into DC.
Well, if you look at Marvel, like go back to Marvel in the '60s, Fantastic Four, Silver Surfer, Thor, all very cosmic.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
So Jim Starlin was riffing off Kirby anyway. But
he also brought this sort of idea of the expanded mind sphere to it. Mm. And this is something Kirby also did in the New Gods. When you look at the Fantastic Four, these are explorers. They are limited to their understanding of the world and the cosmos. There's this wonderful scene, and gives you an inkling about the stuff Kirby would do in the New Gods, is when in the first Galactus story, when the Watcher sends Johnny to fetch the Ultimate
Nullifier. Yeah.
And he comes back and he's basically, he has PTSD. He's totally shocked because he says, well, there are worlds out there. You have no idea what kind of worlds are out there. And this gives you an idea where Kirby would be going eventually. That's quite interesting.
Yeah. Well, even when there's the Silver Surfer story, when they go into the microverse.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So it's, you know,
with worlds within worlds. I mean, this is such an amazing concept.
And which Marvel have been using in Ant-Man. And they use that in Ant-Man and the Avengers
absolutely.
Movies.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure they're going to be going back in there at some point soon.
Have you seen Endgame? It was definitely used.
But what we didn't see is what else is in that world.
Oh yeah, there's a lot more.
I think there's a lot more to come. And if you look visually, look at that. Look at what Ant-Man saw, and then look at what Doctor Strange saw in his. Very similar on a certain level. They were the way they introduced and almost mirrored these different universes, these different worlds. In those two movies, they did kind of the same thing, but, you know, emphasized they're different and expanding out that universe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, man. So, all right. So, you know, let's start wrapping up, boys, because, you know, Kirby could turn into a 10-hour podcast if allowed.
Absolutely true.
We definitely do want to touch more, you know, continue the conversation of Forth, continue his return to Marvel, get into his film and animation experience for a year. And then in those final years, you know, what he did with Pacific, Eclipse, you know, et cetera, and what other troubles he got himself into, unfortunately.
His fight to actually get his own artwork back.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I'm saying, this man has went through a lot of copyright bullshit, because of his fight, you know, a lot of people have opportunity today as well, because he opened doors, you know, to protect others as well. So, you know, this is why he's the king. So he will always be spoken about in high regard to this. I wish that I would have been able to meet him in life. I know, I believe, Dave, you did, correct?
Yeah, I got to meet him several times, in fact.
Several times. You hear this guy, Chris?
Amazing.
I went to his house. I had lunch.
Oh, my God. You had lunch with Jack Kirby.
Yep.
How was that experience before we go?
I've...
That's something you treasure, bro.
Oh yeah, man. I mean, that is. I remember the first time I met Jack. By this point I'd met, you know, Frank Miller, Belsenkevich, all of those guys. And Jack was the first time I met him. It's the first time I've ever been stuck for what to say. He meant that much. And fortunately, Roz helped me out. And she sensed the fact that I was stuck for words.
Yeah.
And at the time, what was interesting is she'd actually pulled him away from a conversation with Frank Miller and John Byrne to talk to me.
Oh, wow. Check that out. Well, yeah, of course, here comes Mr. D.
It was like, I'm going like, oh, no, you didn't need to do that. And Jack's all like, oh, hey, what's up, kid? What's your name? You know, and it's like.
Brooklyn at you.
Yeah, but we had a very brief conversation, but Roz had actually said, come by tomorrow and we'll talk more. And I talked to her a little bit before I spoke to Jack, and I carried on talking to Roz, who is without doubt Jack Kirby's big barter. It's like, you know, those two, I think the thing that was missing from Jack's life was someone he could genuinely trust who had his back on a legal side. Gotcha. He definitely had someone who had his back on a personal family side. It's not widely known, I don't think, but back in the early days, Roz inked a fair bit of Jack Kirby's work, particularly over at DC, doing short stories and covers and things like that.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. Check that out. Amazing. What teamwork. Definitely the barter, for sure. Although we all know who Mr. Miracle was based on, because Jim Steranko won't let me forget it every time I run into him.
Jazzy Jim Steranko.
Yes.
Yeah, man. This dude tells me, I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning every day and I go out for a jog with my dogs. I'm like, at 3 a.m, damn, bro. I look at his age, I look at myself, I'm embarrassed. And then he opens up his jacket and he hits his stomach.
Oh, yeah.
You hear that, boy?
Yeah.
That's a fit man. I'm like, all right. And then he picks up his leg on the table and begins to tell the stories of back in the day. He's one hell of a storyteller, and we definitely should bring him up one of these
days.
And talk about him. And obviously the inspiration behind Mr. Miracle there for Jack.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and when you think about artists who have been around as long as he has, and who is still turning out amazing artwork today.
Oh, yeah. And listen, for his age, the man looks great. He got that youthful energy. Yes. God bless his soul, man. He's definitely a legend. He's the man. So, you know, hopefully I get to see him again in another con. And hopefully even have another podcast one of these days. Shout out the offer.
That would be so cool.
Yeah, definitely. I want to have you guys on with him because I'm pretty sure they will have a fun chat. And Chris, Mr. Steranko.
Yeah, I'll ask him. I'll send him an email. I'll ask him.
Oh man, yeah, tell him. Help the cause.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right, ladies and gentlemen, and with that, thanks for listening to another International Comics Collective. I promise that next time we'll probably do a 2 to 3 hour show because we're going to start digging deeper into a lot of more stuff. Because Chris is writing some awesome, columns via the comiccrusaders.com website. So make sure to check them out. They're out every single Wednesday. Check them out. They're amazing. And Dave, you got to make sure to check out his Twitter feed and obviously his responses to all of Chris's shares. Hell of a great conversation on Twitter if you want to learn about some history and comics. So, gentlemen, anything else you want to shout out before we go?
Dave, you go ahead first.
Well, what I was going to say is, following on from that, and a response to a couple of people, particularly in the last week, that Chris and myself have interacted with on Chris's Twitter stream. Sometimes a lot of people have questions about comics, and while I have to admit I'm not up to date on some of the more, you know, the comics from the last couple of years, but. Comics history creators, if you have a question, please just throw it out to Chris or myself, or Chris and myself, mm-hmm. and Al mm-hmm. on Twitter, I'm more than happy to, you know, to chat.
Yeah, definitely. Let's have a chat.
Please.
What about you, Chris?
Thank you very much. And also thank you for your kind words. And thank you for hosting me. And as I said before, Wednesday, the Kirby column, it's about Mr. Miracle and a lot of other stuff. Check it out. It's a long one. And the week afterwards, I start on Batman. So there's Uh-oh. That. And Uh-oh. Yeah, I'll be sending the first two over very soon. And to you, Alice. And thank you again for listening. And if you have any questions or suggestions, or you want a certain topic discussed here on our podcast, please hit me up on Twitter, hit Dave and Al, and we will see what we can do.
Absolutely. And there you go, folks. Make sure to follow us, ICC and UCPN. And with that, I'm Al Mega with the amazing guys from the International Comics Collective. May you all have a blessed day.
Same to you. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
This is an official Undercover Capes podcast.
Thank you for listening to the ICC and Undercover Capes. Make sure to visit our website, undercovercapes.com, and also visit the International Comics Collective on Twitter.